Bakery Babes would like to say thank you to their sponsors. First of all, the Baker Street Journal, which continues to be the leading Sherlockian publication since its founding in 1986 by Edgar W. Smith. With both serious scholarship and articles that play the game, the journal is essential reading for anyone interested in Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and the world where it is always 1895. Go to www.bakerstreetjournal.com to find out more. We'd also like to say thank you to West Express, who are the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Whether you've just discovered the great detective or you're a seasoned Sherlockian, we're sure you'll find many unique volumes to pique your interest. Go to www.westexpress.com and have a browse. And last but not least, we'd like to say thank you to the Scintillation of Science, which is an annual symposium of fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, which is sponsored by Watson's Tin Box in Maryland, USA. A Scintillation of Science number 6 is going to take place June 7 to 9, 2013 in Hanover, Maryland, and registration is now open. Go to www.scintillation.org.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one be mine?
Rock on. So welcome, ladies, gentlemen, etc., to episode, amazingly enough, 38 now, which wow. is a lovely number, getting up there, of the Baker Street Babes podcast featuring Sherlockian extraordinaire, as we've been saying on Twitter all day, Daniel Stachauer. Yeah!
Yay!
Woohoo!
Yay! Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
We're so happy he's here. Daniel is the author of More Things Than We Can Really Talk About in an intro, because then that would take up the whole interview. So we'll just talk about them, I guess, individually. But most recently, he released In the Hour of Peril, which is basically the thrilling and true life tale, and correct me if I'm wrong on any of these counts, but the thrilling...
No thrilling, true life, that's good.
Yeah, all of the above, batting a thousand so far, of Ellen Pinkerton thwarting an assassination plot that was leveled against Abraham Lincoln before his inauguration as he was traveling cross-country to his inauguration.
That's right.
Yeah. And almost, well, it was, I'm going to say, what, 3 months apart? Dan's most recent Sherlockian offering was a nonfiction work called Dangerous Work, co-authored with Mr. John Lillenberg, which is a beautiful annotated exploration of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's diary that he kept during his voyage as a medical student to the Arctic Ocean and the adventures that he had there. So that's two releases in a very short period of time.
Yes, but then I have to sit down and take a load off for a while because, you know, I'm trying to remember who made this joke. I think it was Mel Brooks, you know, that he has to sit down for a while because his feet hurt. But it was really just an accident of timing. Those two books came out so close together. The Arctic Whaling Diary has been brewing for years, and it took us this long to pull it together, and we're really pleased with how it came out. It's just a beautiful, beautiful book.
So stunning, yeah.
They did a wonderful job with it, and it just, we were both kind of taken aback by how we knew how wonderful the diary was, the real document, but they did just such a beautiful job reproducing those illustrations and that facsimile of the diary itself. It's just a gorgeous production.
We had our hands on it briefly, very briefly, because you and John Lillenberg were kind enough to donate one to the Daintiest Thing Under a Bonnet charity ball to benefit Wounded Warrior Project. And it brought in a nice price. So
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. So we have a fair warning, Dan. Once we've completed the questionnaire that we ask at the beginning of each of our podcast episodes, you're going to be an official honorary Baker Street babe. Are you okay with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, more than... Yeah, no, I was hoping.
Your fingers were crossed. Awesome. So these are easy, and there are no right answers, but think hard, because a lot of people are going to be judging.
No pressure, though.
No pressure. Just get it right the first time, okay?
No, I try.
How did you get into Sherlock Holmes initially as a passion?
Well, I'll try to keep this brief, but I can only be so brief because it involves hand grenades and lizard people. When I was about 11 years old or 12, the Cleveland Playhouse, I grew up in Cleveland, and the Cleveland Playhouse was doing a production of the William Gillette play. And I auditioned for the role of Billy. And I really wanted the part. I already had a pretty serious case of Baker Street fever. So I thought, you know, I'm going to nail this part. And I came to the audition wearing a deerstalker and carrying a copy of the canon. And I practiced the line. The line was, "There's someone here to see you, Mr. Holmes." And I thought I nailed it. You know, I had a lot of different readings. "There's someone here to see you, Mr. Holmes." "There's someone here to see you, Mr. Holmes." "There's someone here to see you, Mr. Holmes." And I gave them everything I had. I mean, I emptied both, you know, all the barrels. But somehow I didn't get the part. And, you know, crestfallen, I withdrew. And I decided to make my mark on the theater in a different way. So I wrote a play. Again, Vermont, 12 years old, and the play was called Sherlock Holmes versus the Lizard People.
Mm. It sounds fantastic.
It was great. It was fantastic, but I recall only one line of dialogue, and that was, "Look out, Holmes, that lizard has a grenade."
That's the best line ever.
Well,
how do we get our hands on this?
Yeah,
sadly,
when is it coming out?
Sadly, lost to posterity.
Oh, man.
You know, you can't just go about and recreate a triumph like this, you know, willy-nilly. So, unfortunately, lost to the winds of time.
That is a tragic circumstance.
No, but I soldiered on with the Baker Street stuff, and I still have that deerstalker.
Oh, good. Good. Well, that's a relief anyway. And then you've stuck to it up till at least 5 minutes ago. So, in Sherlockian world. So, since you've clearly read these before, who is your favorite canonical character?
Okay. You know the show Desert Island Discs where they ask if you could take any 8 records along to a desert island, and then they... At the end, they're going to give you a book and a luxury, and they say that the book is they're going to give you the Shakespeare and the Bible so that you don't have to pick those.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to assume that I'm already getting Holmes and Watson.
Nice.
So definitely the character I would want would be Irene Adler.
Mm.
I'm pretty sure most everybody says that, but yeah, that would be my pick.
We support that choice, I think.
We do.
Indeed.
Yes, Amy writes best t-shirts along the Irene Adler lines, and yeah, go girl. Can't drop that one. She's necessary.
I guess my kids would want Toby.
Oh! Your kids are also discerning. He's very important. So then what is your favorite case, which in no way needs to correlate to your favorite canonical character?
You know, it does, though. I mean, my favorite case by far is Scandal in Bohemia, because I love the opening page of that story. I always have. I honestly think that was what sealed the deal for me with Baker Street. That to Sherlock Holmes, she was always the woman. I just, that whole thing, Grit and the Sensitive Instrument, I just love it from start to finish. And then the way it pays off at the end, but I have not heard him do it of late. I just, yeah. It's just music. But for some reason, a close second place for me has always been The Dying Detective. I think because when I read it when I was a kid, I knew that that by the first time I read Final Problem, I knew that Holmes would come back, but I did not know when I read Dying Detective for the first time. It completely had me, and I thought this could be it. I thought I could be reading the last Sherlock Holmes story.
Wow, that is such that's great. I don't know that, I think I had so many, when I was reading them initially, so many cases left in the collection that it didn't have me at the time, but there are so many conversations about this going on right now, especially with today starting just the reading process for the Empty House episode of the BBC Sherlock series, and so many people just had to go through it again.
Yes. Yes. How are we going to get a Cumberbatch off the sidewalk?
Yes. Yes. Scrape him up with a spatula. But it's so much easier knowing that he's going to come back versus not knowing. And I always, just kind of imagine what it must have been like for the people who read The Final Problem when it was published. And
I honestly was a little sad when they did Reichenbach that they had the reveal at the end that he was still alive, because I kind of wanted the new people to have to suffer.
Me too.
Is that horrible?
I see your point. I was almost relieved. I thought that was such a nice touch that we did see him. And I was so completely sold. I just think Martin Freeman is so terrific in that series. But that scene just has stayed with me so much, and that crisp little military turn on his heel that he does as he walks away.
It
was just such a great scene.
Dying Detective is another seriously great, piece of almost, it's almost a set piece, but it's so suspenseful. You don't have really a lot going, you have the bedroom, and then you have just Watson's journey.
Right. And it could be a play.
Easily.
Yeah.
But it's so, there's such heightened tension throughout I don't know that that's an answer anyone's given yet. That's an awesome choice.
It also has those great throwaways, all the business about oysters.
Yeah.
Now, where is that coming from? And I think that's something about Conan Doyle's writing that really vibrated with me when I was a kid, was where is this coming from? We all love the throwaway cases, Giant Rat of Sumatra, Wilson the Notorious Canary Trainer, but this stuff just comes out of nowhere, and one of the great ones is that oysters business, and the way that he keeps coming back to it, while Watson is obviously so concerned, and he's asking about something else, and Holmes keeps circling back to the, whatever it is he says. I suppose they must have natural predators. And I just love it. It's just, it's wonderfully effective, but it's also funny in this very offbeat way, in a way that I think Conan Doyle does all the time and doesn't get credit for.
Definitely.
Oh, absolutely. We've talked before about how one of the major turnoffs for me, I guess, and for several of us, I think, when we're reading pastiches, which we'll talk about your pastiches certainly as well, Dan, but and this is in no way a note to you because you nail it, but Sherlock Holmes and Watson both, they're very funny.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of pastiches that try to just nail this grim Victorian melodrama that's unleavened with humor. And it doesn't work.
I agree with that completely. I think that there's so much there that you can read, and it's you read it and you can read it again and again, and it's not like you forgot who killed Charles Baskerville or whatever. You come back because you're reading these great lines, these wonderful lines, and a lot of those lines have this pawky strain of humor. That bears repeating.
Absolutely. Well, bearing that in mind, all of those points of importance. When you're adapting Sherlock Holmes, what is your favorite adaptation that you've seen on the big or small or radio, for that matter, screen? Not that there's a screen.
Oh, gosh. I mean, there really have been a lot, and I've been very lucky that way. I've seen a lot of terrific productions. I'm going to have to go with the Rathbone Hound, and I'll tell you why. When my mother was a little girl, she used to go visit an uncle in Canada who owned a movie theater, and one of the films that he was showing was the Basil Rathbone Hound of the Baskervilles. And it was decided that she was too young to see this. This movie was too scary. So instead of being able to see it in the movie theater, she crept up into the projection booth, where she saw the movie projected out of the rear of the projector, upside down, on the rear of the projection booth. So that for years and years and years, she thought that the hound could walk on the ceiling because she'd seen it upside down. And I think that made it so much more frightening. So much, so, and I can never watch that movie without thinking, well, yeah, this is pretty good. You know, that's a pretty scary dog. But think how much scarier it would be if you were upside down walking on the ceiling. Or, I suppose, on the sky, if we were out on the moors.
Terrifying. Terrifying. Is that what happened to Rathbone's hair in the later film?
Must be. They hung him upside down for too long, and it didn't quite fall back into place.
It's a hazard of walking on the ceiling too much. You're going to end up with Flock of Seagull's hair.
Well, he's already got the puffy shirt.
He did, yeah. Oh. Kind of a pirate shirt. It was working for him. Brilliant, brilliant. So, final question, and then you are an official honorary Baker Street babe. If you could, from the whole canon, and this is, you know, completely different from your favorite character, but if you could have tea and chat with one of the characters from the canon, who would that be?
Oh, boy, I really should have thought this one through.
Wow, did we see them on people like spider monkeys?
So I'm having tea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I'm tempted to say Mrs. Hudson because I'm married to a Scottish woman, and you know she has as good an idea of breakfast as anyone, and she's actually far, far, far more partial to tea than I am. But I guess I would probably go with Professor Moriarty. I just like to be able to say that I sat across the. Sat across the table from him, just the once. Last night, I'm slowly indoctrinating my 13-year-old son into the ways of Baker Street. And last night, we watched Game of Shadows. And there's that wonderful scene in the restaurant with Irene and Moriarty. And I've seen that movie a couple of times now, but that's my favorite scene. So I guess I guess I'm thinking of that.
I just like you cackling wickedly, talking about indoctrinating your 13-year-old into
well,
circle.
Yeah.
Going,
it's I'm trying to do it with a light touch because you know I don't want to push too hard. You know, this is Dad's thing, and I don't want to force it on him and have him sort of rebuff it because it's Dad's thing. But I figure it's time. He is working his way through. The David Suchet Poirot series. And he really likes that. And he really likes Monk. A lot of other things. So, you know, I feel
It's the perfect time.
Yeah, the path has been worn. It's time to spring the trap. We've been reading some of the stories. We've watched some Jeremy Brett's. I haven't shown him any Rathbones yet. So we haven't seen the Upside Down Hound, but he's now seen both of the Robert Downey Jr. movies and liked them a lot. And he keeps inquiring after Sherlock, but I don't know how you feel about this, but I sort of feel he should get a little more of the original under his feet before he goes for Sherlock, but maybe I'm turned around on that.
You mean because there's so many in-jokes in that series? Or
I guess that's what I mean. I sort of feel like... as good as it is on its own, and as much as it appeals to the non-Sherlockians, it just there's that whole level I'd love for him to click on the first time he sees it.
I feel like people come at that two ways. I mean, they either see it and they've never read the canon, and there's, you know, at this point, thousands upon thousands of these people who have then gone to the canon and said, oh my god, when they say Vatican cameos to each other, and that's code for duck and rubber,
yeah.
Then they feel like they've found an Easter egg that's planted in the original canon, which I think is just as pleasing. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
People come at it, yeah, I definitely understand that perspective on the subject, because you would miss a lot with Sherlock if you weren't familiar with the... But the little in-jokes, you know, they're not...
It's not make or break, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see your point. I mean, the other thing is he's already a big fan of Martin Freeman because of The Hobbit and because of Hitchhiker's Guide. I have to say, my 13-year-old son has exquisite taste. He's a big fan of Martin Freeman already, so maybe Sherlock would be a way to go.
Well, it's up to you as a parent and a Sherlockian.
Well, all right, then.
And now officially as an honorary Baker Street babe. Congrats!
Oh, well. Yay. Wait till I tell my wife. Honey, you'll never guess. I'm a babe.
She'll hope you have something Scottish and delightful.
Exactly.
We have so many things we want to chat with you about that I'm almost at a loss as to which direction to go first, but I know that we're very excited about your new book, and the timing's just perfect for that. Hour of Peril, and I know Taylor wanted to talk to you about it. I wanted to talk to you about it. We're ready to chat about that because it really ties into early detective work and the way...
Oh, boy, that's for sure.
Yeah, the way people just perceived forensics at the time, and this is pre-Sherlock Holmes, so there's a lot to talk about there. Taylor, did you want to...
I guess we'll just start right out of the box. Where did the idea come from? What made you latch onto this particular piece of history?
Well, there's the official version, and then there's the real version. The official version, and it's true, is that a lot of different roads led me there. You know, I've always been fascinated with Sherlock Holmes, and as you will know, we learn in Valley of Fear that if a Pinkerton man is deep in this business, we are all destroyed. And my first job out of grad school was at Time Life Books, and I worked on their Civil War series and came to know several of the figures who feature in the story, including Colonel Ellsworth, the gallant little colonel who was with Lincoln on the journey to Baltimore, and Timothy Webster, who was at Pinkerton's side throughout. And then finally I became intrigued by Kate Warne, America's first female private eye, who worked for Pinkerton and headed a female detective agency for him that began in the 1850s, if you can believe that. And her story has been a bug in my ear for a long time. But if I'm honest with myself, a lot of it ties back to a comic book I read in a treehouse in 1971. It was an issue of True Comics. It told the story of the Baltimore plot. So as Conan Doyle said of his first reading of Poe, I read it when my mind was young and plastic, and it made a deep impression and stuck with me ever since. It's only taken me about 40 years to do it, but here it is.
About how long did it take to do all that research for that, too? When you say 40 years from, you mean from the way back when idea, but how long had you been working on the book?
You know, this will sound glib, but a lot of my books are things that I've always been interested in, and it's hard to tell when I officially, you know, began working on them. And, you know, it's certainly true with Conan Doyle. I haven't stopped, even after... Teller Tales came out. I still feel I learned something new about Conan Doyle every day. With this one, I can fairly say that, you know, it was my last book of this sort was The Beautiful Cigar Girl in 2007. And I've been working on this book pretty solidly since then. But I've always had an interest in Pinkerton and related subjects. So a lifelong interest that really concentrated over the last 5 years.
So in light of that, to what extent do you think the Valley of Fear version of the Pinkertons either did or did not ring true for you as someone who is looking at this as a historian, as opposed to Conan Doyle, who's looking at it as a writer of hopefully a page-turner? and is trying to call the most salacious details that he can.
You know, I always find that very interesting to see how Conan Doyle scooped up things that were really going on in the world and managed to extract the parts of them that would make for good fiction. I mean, you see that in The Hound of the Baskervilles, where he scoops up a piece of folklore and turns it into obviously very compelling fiction, and you see it here too. I mean, he was careful to make sort of a nod to disguise some of the features of the Molly Maguire's case, so that he could turn the facts to his own purposes, which obviously he did in a number of ways. But he was clearly up on the facts of the case and very interested in what really happened. But as with a lot of his fiction, I don't think he felt too closely tethered to the actual facts, at least not so far as it would limit his storytelling, you know.
Monkey serum can keep you young, Dan.
Yeah. I think history will show that that's true.
Regarding the forensic techniques that the Pinkertons were using, I know that part, you know, just as a longtime fan of Sherlock Holmes, he seems to be using techniques that the Yard is not on board with in many ways. I mean, Lestrade at a certain point in The Norwood Builder kind of shows off that he knows what fingerprints mean, but to an enormous extent, Sherlock Holmes is noticing things no one else is noticing. To what extent do you think the Pinkertons were doing the same, and much earlier?
I think that there were a lot of techniques that the Pinkertons got the ball rolling on, and one of them that I think Sherlock Holmes would have appreciated was Pinkerton had what can only be called a good old index in the Chicago headquarters, where they gathered information and indexed it so that they would be able to go back to their records if they found out that a particular criminal had a particular MO or a distinguishing scar or a peculiar way of walking. They would have records on this, and they would be able to go to their records and see who they had in their files who matched that description. And this was very forward-looking at that time, and because at a time when in America, criminal jurisdictions really only extended as far as state and county lines, he managed to become a central clearinghouse of information in a way that I think would have greatly appealed to Sherlock Holmes.
To what extent was that influenced or inspired by, was Bertillon earlier than that, with the measuring people?
Yes, but, you know, it's funny, Pinkerton was very aware of Vidocq, and seems to have studied and enjoyed his memoir, which, you know, we know was fanciful to a great extent, but still inspired Pinkerton greatly, and the Pinkertons were great ones for assuming different identities, and going out in disguise. And Pinkerton would often change his style of facial hair and things like that. And who does that remind you of?
So he was very much a figure who sort of transcended the Pinkerton agency itself, was he not? In the sense that I think that probably today more people would know about Alan Pinkerton as just the center and as the brains behind the operation than they would think of specific people who were strike breakers or other, you know, breakouts from that community. Is that true?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that that I was so keen to write this book is that there's a lot of controversy and misunderstanding about who Pinkerton was and what he did. I had a guy come up to me and sort of poke his finger in my chest, and he says, "Alan Pinkerton cracked my grandfather over the head with a club at Homestead and put him in the hospital." And I knew just what he was talking about. He's referring to the Homestead strike in Pennsylvania in 1892, and this was a truly horrific clash between striking steelworkers and Pinkerton men, and there was blood and casualties and horrific consequences on both sides. But I can tell you for sure that Alan Pinkerton did not put anybody's grandfather in the hospital that day. And this is because he was dead. He died 8 years earlier. And it's been my experience that, you know, dead men crack no skulls. Look, I'm not here to apologize for some of the things that Pinkerton did and that were done on his watch. But there's a story behind Pinkerton that never gets told. And it's the story of a man who comes to America from Scotland as a cooper, a barrel maker, and somehow works his way up to become the foremost, the top lawman in the country. And he makes his bones protecting America's railroads. Everybody knows about the strike breaking, and everybody knows about his failures as the head of General McClellan's Union Intelligence in the early years of the Civil War. But I rarely meet anyone who knows that Pinkerton ran a station on the Underground Railroad and helped fugitive slaves make their way north to freedom. I rarely meet anyone who knows that he was a close friend of John Brown, the abolitionist, even though his friendship with Brown put him on the wrong side of the law in the days leading up to Harper's Ferry. Mm-hmm. So he's a man of strong contrasts. As his friend Lincoln might have said, he was a house divided against himself. And I think one of the most interesting characters, one of the most interesting American stories of the 19th century.
Oh, it definitely comes across that way in the book, too. I completely understand what you mean, because I kind of had this image in my head of what you hear Pinkerton are, the things like the failure and the Civil War and things, and after reading this, I kind of have a totally different point of view. There's so much more to it.
Well, yeah, we think of the Pinkertons as, you know, tough guys, big fists, blazing guns. You know, that you remember that scene in Butch Cassidy, where Butch and Sundance are being chased by this relentless posse of lawmen, and Paul Newman says, you know, can you do that? I can't do that. Who are those guys? Well, you know, they're Pinkertons. But there was more to the story than that.
Well, it's great that you'll probably be encountering from here on out a lot more people who've heard that story since your book on the subject exists and is I've seen a lot of it in all sorts of venues, so congrats on how well it's doing.
Well, thank you kindly.
Should we talk ACD?
I'm game if you are.
The subject of Arthur Conan Doyle's biographies, I mean, in a lot of ways is really interesting, I think, because you've got all mixed up in it the concept of playing the game. For instance, previous to, you published a Conan Doyle biography called Teller of Tales, which won the Edgar Award in, I think it was 1999?
Yes.
For Best Biographical, because it's awesome. And previous to that, I know that John Lallenberg had put a collection together that was called The Quest for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, 13 Biographers in Search of a Life, that he put together, and Dame Jean Conan Doyle wrote the introduction to it. And there's a lot of Sherlockian and Doylean scholars who appear listed, quoted in that work, who you know, contributed articles. You have both Redmonds, you have Peter Blau, Lallenberg, Richard Lanthlin Green, Christopher Redmond, you have Schroeder as well. And prior to that collection appearing, I'm sure that the study of Conan Doyle's life must have been in some ways popular, but I don't know that, and I'm in no position to know, but it didn't seem to be particularly comprehensive in a scholarly manner. I mean, what led you to, after that Lallenberg collection was published, what led you to decide to put together a very readable, but at the same time, very complete work about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's life, apart from Sherlock Holmes and including Sherlock Holmes?
There was really only one reason, and it was spiritualism. What I was interested in was how Conan Doyle came to devote so much of his life to spiritualism, the belief that it's possible for the living to communicate with departed souls through a spirit conduit or medium. And it was a question that has always fascinated me. I felt that it really, apart from the one biography that was written by a fellow spiritualist, it felt to me like it hadn't been addressed as comprehensively as I would have liked to have seen it up to that time. And a lot of the biographers, again, to my way of thinking, sort of backed off when they got to that point. I love the John Dixon Carr biography. Mm-hmm. But when he gets to spiritualism, he says something to the effect of, there's something about this man that escapes analysis. You know, to someone who, like me, the poor biographer, is too much of the earthy, which is, you know, very gracefully done, but it doesn't really answer the question. And it seemed to me that if we were going to really look at the life, you had to understand, or at least attempt to understand, where the life ended up. And he spent the last 14 years of his life devoted almost entirely to spiritualism. Well, why? And I don't think you have to believe in spiritualism. I don't think you have to believe in that we should be sitting in seance rooms communicating with departed spirits in order to look at that subject with some sympathy and understanding. It was something that was very much in the air at the time, and there was something in Conan Doyle's nature that demanded of him that he pursue it. And I felt it was an interesting subject to pursue, and when I started writing that book, it was much, much more tilted towards the spiritualism than it subsequently became. Why cooler heads prevailed, and I wound up writing a more general biography than I had first anticipated, and I can't bring myself to complain about that now. But I dove in thinking, I really want to look at this part of his life. I really want to look at how the creator of Sherlock Holmes, the ultimate rational being, gave so much of his life over to a subject that seems to so many of us to be entirely irrational.
Well, it seemed like there was quite a wave of spiritualism going on, not only in the wake of the Great War, but also in the wake of the Titanic tragedy, for people who were affected by that in all parts of the northeastern seaboard as well. So to what extent do you think, then, having written this biography, was this a question of a paradigm, or was it deeply personal? Was it both? And did you answer that question?
Well, I don't think anyone can pretend, you know, any biographer can pretend to have resolved an issue like that for good and all. But I think in his case, it's fairly easy to say that the war in particular was what prompted him to become so public with his belief in spiritualism. But his belief predated the war by a long time. You know, it's a commonplace for people to say, well, it's understandable, he lost his son in the war. Well, yes, he did. But when he got that news, he was on his way to deliver yet another lecture on spiritualism. I mean, that's not what turned the corner for him. It certainly made him, the war and his own personal losses made him far, far more outspoken than he might have been otherwise. But his belief, or at least his interest, his openness towards the idea of psychic phenomenon, went back a long way. He liked to say, and it was true, that he had contributed an article, a letter really, to a psychic magazine dozens of years before he, I guess you would say today, came out as a spiritualist. And that was true. He was on record as having a very, very long-standing interest, even before the birth of the son who passed away in the war.
That's interesting. I had, no idea that it was quite that that long-standing in terms of, you think of ways that people, after a truly tragic event, try to cope with it, and I think that most people think of Arthur Conan Doyle having flung himself to a great extent into spiritualism after the fact, and, you know, as you unearth, that's simply not true. He had always been intrigued by the supernatural, which I think also we have to remember at the time was a perfectly legitimate branch of science to a lot of people who imagined that the intangible could be measured. And we find that the intangible can be measured all the time now. It just can't be measured in quite the way they thought it could.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a good way of looking at it. I mean, there were a lot of men of science who felt that this was a frontier that was there to be explored, and that might was an issue that might be resolved in their lifetimes. You know, men like Oliver Lodge and a lot of other scientists. But it was in Conan Doyle's nature that once he was convinced, you know, his voice needed to be out there. And he wrote very, very eloquently and very persuasively and spoke about it all over the world. And it got to, he really was good at it. And I'm sure you've seen the Movie Tone interview towards the end of his life where he comes out, sits in that chair in the back garden and starts talking very charmingly about Sherlock Holmes and then says, but now on to the far more important issue. and that's really wonderful. He sets the hook with Sherlock Holmes, and then he moves on to the issue that, you know, he often called the most important thing in the world. And he really thought it was.
I don't know if I've got the timeline correct here, but there is... I also hope I have the case correct. I think it might be Sussex Vampire, where Holmes sort of, with a single statement, dismisses any possibility of there being supernatural forces in this world.
Yes, this agency stands flat-footed on the ground.
Yes, exactly.
No ghosts need apply.
What were Conan Doyle's spiritualist beliefs already developed at that point? That story.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. And you, for better or worse, stumbled on something that really, really interests me, because I'm sure you've read the Professor Challenger books. Well, Challenger went over to spiritualism. You know, here Conan Doyle has a character who's very popular. Mm-hmm. The Lost World is a terrific book, as we all know. But in Conan Doyle's hands, Challenger became an instrument of spreading the spiritualist message in the Land of Mist.
Commented on that too. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's just, what a switch.
So why not Sherlock Holmes? That's something that's a question that has always fascinated me. And people always say, well, you know, of course not Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes would never have believed this. You know, Sherlock Holmes would never have believed in spiritualism. He was the ultimate rational being. Well, sure. I know that,
right?
And you know that, but Conan Doyle was the last person in the world to be swayed by that argument, and it's always always fascinated me that he had this. He never brought out the big gun.
It makes me think of Dorothy Sayers. I believe it's in The Mind of the Maker. She talks about people asking her why she didn't have Lord Peter Wimsey share some of her beliefs, and her answer to that was, because he wouldn't like it. That character had such an identity to her, but it's kind of interesting because it doesn't seem like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle necessarily had that in many areas of his life. So it's an interesting question.
Yeah, but that's a great thing. That really is.
To a certain extent, too. I mean, if Conan Doyle was so on so many levels, as we've seen, as reported by you, reported by others, since he was so determined to believe in spiritualism, wouldn't it be easier for the character that he hated not to believe in it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. That's a fair point, too. You see with Challenger, in a way, the progression is, here's a man who, in every book, is exploring some new plane. Who's exploring some new realm of science.
Right.
And in Conan Doyle's, to Conan Doyle's way of thinking, I think it's fair to say that spiritualism was just the next one. And it does make a lot of sense when you look at it in those terms. But boy, it did not make for a very good novel.
Mm-mm. No. until the ball drops, then particle physics isn't real and it's all run by a giant hamster. We're going to be so embarrassed.
And the answer is 42.
The answer is 42. That's it. There's nothing beyond 42. Oh, man. Well, so after Teller of Tales, I don't know at what point you started working with John Ellenberg and the Arthur Conan Doyle estate, but you started exploring previously unpublished letters written
yes.
by Arthur Conan Doyle mostly to his mother,
mm-hmm.
which is lovely, but to other people as well, and you traveled all over the world reading them, and that is a fascinating project because you had already written a biography of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Now you're publishing letters commentating on them, and they're not previously ones that had seen the light of day in some cases. I mean, can you talk about how you went about that research and whether any of your opinions changed about ways that you may have reported the biography previously or had been, you know, sort of made more three-dimensional by reading these new pieces?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's hardly a day that goes by where I don't, particularly when John and I were working on that book with Charles Foley, we're not strangers to the world of Conan Doyle. We felt that between us, among the three of us, we knew a good deal about Conan Doyle, and every day, we were finding out some new and surprising thing about him, and some of it was, you know, pretty small potatoes, like, but for instance, he was reading Jane Austen at one point, really enjoying it. Well, who knew? But there were all kinds of things that just accumulated into a whole lot that I wish I had known when I was writing Teller of Tales, but it just shows how multifaceted that life was, how many different areas that he was reaching out into at all times, and how relentlessly curious he was, that there was just new stuff happening all the time. But what I particularly loved about working on life and letters was you hear Conan Doyle speaking to you directly in a voice that is more deeply personal and unguarded than the one you hear in his published works. And it's absolutely charming, but it is also so heartfelt,
mm-hmm.
because you are seeing this incredibly important relationship, his relationship with his mother, as it develops from the time he was a schoolboy straight through to the end of her life. And you know, it has a narrative arc in the same way that a Conan Doyle novel does, because he's a schoolboy, and then he's a young, struggling doctor trying to make his way in the world, trying to show her, no, really, this is all going to work out. I do have a plan. This is all going to work out. I did this. I sent this to this magazine. Didn't this work out? Until finally, he's Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and he's had this incredible success, and it's given him so much pleasure to be able to share it with her. But there were also some incredible things, some things that really surprised us, you know, almost on every page. One of the things that that I love that happens in Life and Letters that I certainly had not known about before was his reluctance to accept the knighthood when it was offered to him.
Oh, that's so appropriate.
Yeah, he says something to the effect of, you know, all my work, he's talking about his Boer War work, it would all be tainted if I accepted a reward. And he likens it to I think the phrase was, the badge of the provincial mayor. You know, he seemed to think that there was something unseemly about the knighthood. And he says, you know, I couldn't possibly do it. And then he says, and forgive me because I'm going to get this wrong because it's been a few years, but there's something that he says to her, and he says, the title that I treasure most, Mother, is that of doctor, which I earned through your hard work, you know, because it was her dedication and her hard work that enabled him to go to medical school in the first place. And he says, I hope that I shall not be asked to descend from it to any other. Well, you know, that's artfully done. That is very artfully done. But as anyone who's ever had a mother knows, she eventually wore him down. And he took the knighthood. And I don't think there were any regrets in the end. But you see this kind of thing playing out between them, and it's just wonderful.
This must be the difference with Sherlock Holmes when he was asked to take the knighthood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, and it's notable that as we all know, Dr. Watson had a tendency to be careless with dates. But we know the year that happened. It was right around. It was right at the same time.
That's so cute. Yeah, that's just the sweetest. So as far as the letters go, not to move off of Life and Letters quickly because it's such a wonderful book, but there's quite the arc, as you were saying, between ACD's home situation before he went to medical school and his situation with his father that led to him having an extremely close relationship with his mother, who seems like she was in every way wonderful, you know, human. And very hardworking, as he mentioned in possibly the best ode to moms of all time that you just brought up. But can you give a little context of that for people who might not know about what his early life looked like?
Well, he was fond of saying that he was raised in the hearty and bracing atmosphere of poverty, which is a very cheerful way of saying that times were hard. And as we all know, he came from a family of very talented artists, and his father Charles was certainly an extremely gifted artist, but suffered from various complaints, and seems to have had a fondness for alcohol. And over time, his income from his surveyor's post in Edinburgh could no longer be counted on. The family moved from place to place very often. And it fell to his mother to hold the family together, which she did with surprising skill and success. And somehow money was found to send, to give Arthur an absolutely first-class education. But throughout his life, he was conscious of the sacrifices that had been made to secure his start in life. And he felt a very heavy responsibility from his earliest days starting out in medical practice to help provide for not only his mother, but his sisters and his younger brothers, which he did from as early as he possibly could and throughout his life.
I'm curious if you think that influences the way women are drawn in the canon, because so many of them are just, you know, owning it, that he was thinking of, you know, the way he grew up and that he was not necessarily actively basing them on direct people from his biography, but you would think that having a mother who basically, you know, saved your ass would lead to you writing characters like Irene Adler and Violet Hunter and Kitty Winter and Lady Hilda, etc.
Yeah, I do think that there's a lot to be said for that, but you know, at the same time, he was no feminist. I mean, he ran afoul of the suffragette. But then again, this phrase seems to keep coming up. There were definitely contrasts there. I mean, but then he was a staunch defender of, you know, divorce rights for women, and didn't feel that women should be trapped without recourse and should have legal options available to them.
Almost by accident.
Well, yeah, there's no easy answer to that. That, you know, there really isn't. Yes, you do see in his fiction the women are there for more than just decoration.
I can't think of one in the canon who is your classic stereotypical poisoner other than one that's alluded to offhandedly and doesn't appear.
No, and he was very candid. Oh, yeah. The most winning woman I knew. Is that who you're thinking of?
Yeah.
And he was very candid about saying that he felt that his gifts as a storyteller came from his mother, you know, who had this lifelong interest in tales of chivalry and that she told him as a young man, and you can see that that cast a long shadow, too. So, yes, his mother was a hugely influential figure.
Any other aspects of the letter specifically that that you thought were just delightful or unmissable?
There are so many, and there's just so much in there that's charming in a, you know, in a Sherlockian way, and thread that runs through it that John and I both loved was Conan Doyle almost talking about investments, and a lot of what he's talking about to his mother was reporting on how he was investing their money.
Ah.
And most of these didn't work out. And one of them was for a concern called Kent Cole. And if I'm remembering correctly, Kent Cole was going to, it was a plan for mining coal in, I think, Wales or something like that, in a region that was not known for coal. But he had invested heavily, and it was, I think the phrase was, wildly financed and extravagantly handled. And it was going to make the county of, it must have been Kent, of course, a coal-producing region. And so one night they're having a dinner for the shareholders, and the dinner is supposed to be cooked with Kent Cole. And they come to find out it has every quality of coal, save one. It won't burn.
It doesn't burn.
So they had to send out and buy something that would burn in order that they could have this this dinner for the shareholders. And that pretty much is illustrative of how of Conan Doyle's fortunes as an investor.
Wow. That's impressive. That is nice. I had asked earlier, and I don't know if you'd like to or not, but we should mention, for sure we should talk about Dangerous Work, because it's just gorgeous, and in every way a very, very cool offering for fans of not only Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, but people who follow Sherlock Holmes and people who are just bibliophiles and like gorgeous books, because as we were mentioning, it's so pretty. But as a way of introducing Dangerous Work, do you mind reading a wee excerpt we talked about earlier from Teller of Tales, because I think that you are a very good teller of tales yourself, sir.
Oh, pshaw.
And this is this sort of sums up the some of the excitement, but in Dan's words, of what is covered in Dangerous Work, which is regarding, as you can explain, the voyage on the Hope ship that Conan Doyle took as a medical student.
Well, it's funny you should ask, because I just happen to have that passage to which you were referring in front of me. And as I struggle here to put on my old man reading glasses, yes, here it is. Despite the inauspicious start, Conan Doyle soon became adept at hopping from one ice floe to another, so much so that he soon went off hunting by himself like any other member of the crew. One afternoon, while crouching over a freshly killed seal, he stood up to change position and slipped backward off the edge of the ice. Sheepishly, he reached up to pull himself out of the frigid water, but his hand slipped off the slick rim of ice. Fighting off panic, Conan Doyle tried another spot. He clawed frantically, but could not find a handhold on the smooth, glassy edge. No one had seen him fall in, and Conan Doyle realized, as both a medical man and a sailor, that he would be dead in minutes if he could not get himself back on the ice. Worse, he could feel the frigid water doing its work. His limbs were growing numb and would soon be useless. He remembered the seal he had been skinning. With a desperate effort, he churned the water with his legs, extending his reach just enough to grab hold of the dead animal's hind flipper. Using the seal as leverage, he began hauling himself out The dead seal's carcass began sliding toward him across the ice, yielding to his weight. Conan Doyle knew that if he dragged the animal over the edge of the ice, he would certainly die. For a few tense moments, there was a, quote, a kind of nightmare tug of war, close quote, with Conan Doyle trying to ease himself over the rim
before the animal came crashing down on top of him. At last, he got one knee out of the water and flipped onto the ice beside the dead creature. Once again, the great northern diver, as he was known, finished the day in bed. This time, swallowing his clothes before he could even manage to remove them. That's kind of the story. That's kind of a story that we hear in Dangerous War. That's kind of the life he was living. It's an incredible adventure, made all the more compelling in the pages of Dangerous War by hearing it in his own words. Here he is, he's a young man having his first great adventure. He has, sort of on the whim of a moment, suspended his medical studies to go off on this long and dangerous adventure on a whaling ship. And he just decides he's going to keep a record of it, which he diligently did in these blank notebooks that he carried along. And what's so wonderful about it is not only did he keep this journal, and it amounts to about 25,000 words, but also, we were talking earlier, he's from a family of artists, and there are about 70 pen and ink drawings, some of them hand-colored, all captioned. And we see here, as nowhere else, that the 20-year-old Arthur Conan Doyle had art in the blood.
So do you see some early signs in there of the narrative style that would later become what he was famous for?
Yes, absolutely. In particular, there's one passage where he describes when they first come upon a whale, and, you know, anyone else in lesser hands, he describes this scene of he's down in his cabin and he hears a bustle on the deck and he hears the captain's voice shout, "Lower away the two waste boats." And he goes up and he describes one of his shipmates running onto the deck with his, in his shirt, with his trousers in his hand. You know, he gives you this scene of the men scrambling,
yeah,
like firemen answering a bell. And he talks about the crews jumping in and the whaling boats rushing out over the water. God, how does he describe it? It's the boats go out. He describes the oars as being like spider's legs, you know, as they row towards the whale, and the harpooner, who's an old hand, is in Conan Doyle's telling of it, standing there calm, waiting for just the right moment. And the way he tells you this is by saying, Connor says, you know, "Not yet, not yet," and he turns a quid of tobacco in his cheek. You know, and with that detail, he's showing you how casual, how practiced, how calm he is. And it's these little details that you see Conan Doyle making use of in his description that show you that there is a real talent rising up and finding its own measure.
Oh, that is
on this voyage. And it makes the diary very exciting to read, not only because it's a chronicle of a very interesting series of events, but also because you feel Conan Doyle kind of feeling his way. I could describe this one way, but I think I'll describe it this way. And you feel him trying things out. There's even him writing little pieces of poetry in this journal. He's clearly testing himself in more ways than one. And, so we get a poem in this diary. Here he is. He's almost at the Arctic Circle, but he's jotting down poetry in his notebook. And it really is wonderful to see this young man sort of finding himself. He says at one point, "I came of age... I came of age at 90 degrees north latitude," and it's absolutely wonderful to see him experimenting with this, finding his way in the company of sailors, and just reveling in this adventure that he's having. A young man on his first great adventure.
Do you think that he had the idea already at at that stage that he might possibly publish these at a later date, or do you think that this was something that he was doing as a labor of love?
You know, I don't think that he did imagine publishing this. He obviously hung on to the notebook, and it's an absolutely wonderful thing, and an important record that he drew on later when writing short stories and articles about his whaling experience. But, you know, because he was a great one, Conan Doyle didn't leave a lot in the dressing room. You know, he didn't waste a lot of words. But I don't think he ever gave thought to publishing this.
He based a couple of, we had a question via Twitter for you from Sherlock NYC asking about how formative his years at sea were going to be to the development of his characters and his stories. But he wrote a couple works of short fiction based on that voyage, did he not?
Oh, absolutely. You got Captain of the Pole Star, which was a tremendously important story for him. And it got him noticed in publishing circles as a promising young writer. We can clearly see how that was drawn on his experiences and other short stories, even J. Habakkuk Jeffson's Statement. And, of course, we see that there are a lot of sailors in the home stories. Not least Black Peter, of course. You know, how many times did we see a particular knot tied that showed the hand of a sailor? And all kinds of things that clearly were drawing on the experiences he had in the Arctic.
Well, and other than Dr. John Watson, I would be loath to name a sexier canonical character than Captain Jack Crocker. That fella just rolls in and, you know, kicks ass and takes names. Yeah, he seemed to have a big respect for people who had been at sea. And I just found the way you ended that chapter about the Great Northern Diver in Teller Tales was a really cool quote. He says, quote, "I went on board the whaler, a big, straggling youth. I came off a powerful, well-grown man," end quote.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And it was very, very important to him that he was not just along on the voyage as a surgeon who was going to sit by while others did the work. It was very important to him to become a member of the crew, to do his work alongside these men. And at one point he says in the diary, he was very proud of himself when Colin McLean, the first mate, paid him a compliment, and he said, "I have no fears of you, surgeon. I'll back you to do a day's work with any man on board. You suit me, and I like the style of you the first time I saw you. I hate your clean-handed gentleman." And Conan Doyle adds, "This was a high compliment from taciturn Colin." And this pleased him very much. You know, here he is, he's in the company of sailors, and he's being accepted.
Yeah, none of the characters that come to our leap to our mind from the Sherlock Holmes mysteries have particularly clean hands either. I mean, even Sherlock Holmes
not afraid to get his hands dirty, absolutely.
Covered in sticking plaster and various nicks and scars and poisons and burns and whatnot. Mm.
And calluses and, marks left on knees and teeth and all kinds of things. Men getting their canine knocked out.
Yeah, by Matthews in Charing Cross Station. Yes, that must have been with early dental work or Victorian dental. Anyway, terrible experience.
Oh, poor guy.
So I have to know, you travel to all kinds of Sherlockian, like, scholarly hotspots for the Doyle works that you do. You've written based on research done in London and in Edinburgh and Oxford and all over the place. So did you take a cross-country Amtrak trip for In the Hour of Peril?
You know, the train tracks have changed a lot since the days when Lincoln was making his journey from Springfield to Washington, D.C. But I did visit a lot of the states where Lincoln stopped on that train. Starting in Illinois and making my way through New York and New Jersey and finishing up, obviously, here in Washington, D.C. But that trip that he took was absolutely nuts. It didn't help that there wasn't a single direct railway line, you know, to get from one place to another. The railroad system in those days looked like somebody had thrown a handful of dry spaghetti on a map. It was this patchwork of independent regional lines. So Lincoln had to make all these different transfers from one station to the next, and that's where the problem arose. But he wound up crisscrossing over 2,000 miles on 18 different railroad lines, and occasionally his route doubled back on itself and circled around. But he wanted to visit different state capitals and speak to as many people as he could. He wanted to offer calming words to the North and extend a hand of reconciliation to the South. So this was very important to him. Happily, I had the advantage of, you know, airplanes. So for the most part, I was able to get places more easily than he did. But it was a pleasure and very, very interesting to stop in a lot of the places that he did and to see that in a lot of them, there are plaques to mark the spots where he stopped in 1861 on his way. Even if it was just to step to the back of the train and sort of, as he phrased it, bow to friends before the train moved on. The fact that Lincoln stopped here is always noted.
So, too, for lack of a better term, switch tracks a little. You.
Oh, I see what you did there. Very clever.
You've written Sherlockian pastiches in which Sherlock Holmes interacts with Harry Houdini, I believe.
Yes.
And other ones as well. I mean, you've written Sherlockian pastiches in slightly longer format, shorter format. I mean, to leave your historical stuff aside for just a second, how is that a completely different thinking cap when you're writing Sherlockian, you know, when you get into the John Watson voice and you sit down and you're, you know, writing an adventure? How does that switch for you? Like when you're writing The Ectoplasmic Man, for instance, which actually was just reprinted in the Further Adventures of Sherlock Holmes series, which is awesome, but I think it was initially printed in the 80s at some point, right?
Yeah, I was in graduate school, and I was in a writing program, you know, a graduate writing workshop, and all around me there were people writing novels about being sensitive young people who feel alienated and take long walks in the rain, and you know, I was sensitive and young and much given to feelings of alienation, and I wasn't averse to taking long walks in the rain. And so I was working on one of those novels, mm-hmm. you know, how my family didn't really understand me, and you know that kind of thing. And it really wasn't going anywhere, and I had enough sense to realize it wasn't going anywhere. And one night, really, it honestly was just a lark. I decided to start writing this novel in which my two obsessions at that time, which were Sherlock Holmes and the world of magic, intersected. And that was via Conan Doyle and Houdini having known each other in real life. And it seemed to me that, since Conan Doyle and Houdini knew each other in real life, it was a natural for Houdini and Sherlock Holmes to make it. I didn't expect it to go anywhere. In a very short time, I found myself much, much, much more interested in my Sherlock Holmes pastiche than I was in my sensitive young guy novel.
Yeah.
And sure enough, you know, before long, I'd finished it and was able to get a contract for it, and honestly, never looked back.
That's the best. I did almost exactly the same thing. I was trying to write, like, you know, Catcher in the Rye, set in the Pacific Northwest, with shades of Kurt Cobain, and I was bored out of my mind.
Yeah, I figured if I couldn't get myself interested in it, I wasn't going to have much luck getting anybody else interested.
That's got to be true on a very basic level. Okay, so writers out there, if you're listening to this podcast, if you are bored,
you know, I haven't written much. I haven't written much fiction lately, apart from short stories. But I do like to write short stories whenever an opportunity arises, because, it, as you'll appreciate, Lindsay, you know, using as much historical research as you do, sometimes it's nice just to write dialogue. You know, just to have people say things, just to make some stuff up. And it's it comes as a real release to you know, give one part of your brain a chance to cool down and let another one heat up while you switch to this different set of neurons. And I really love it. But I don't do as much fiction as I'd like.
I hadn't even thought of that, but you must be very left-brained when you're writing biography.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, writing this this last book, which deals so heavily in Lincoln and the start of the Civil War, you know, it's a huge amount of research, and obviously an enormous amount of factual work. In a way, I feel like Conan Doyle prepared me for that. Because if there's anything we learn when you write about Sherlock Holmes or Conan Doyle is, boy, you got to get it right. Because if you don't, there are a whole lot of people out there waiting to tell you that you got it wrong.
Ooh, and some of them have rifles.
Yeah. Some of them have air guns.
They do. Some have air guns, and some think the South will rise again. So there's an extra. There's a lot of really, really avid Civil War historians who I can't imagine how they keep all of that in their brains. I mean, I'm already baffled by how much ripperologists can keep in their brains at any given time, let alone
Civil War
historians. I mean, that's amazing.
The ripperologists,
same here.
That's a whole other area where it's you just can't believe how much there is.
Yeah, totally. And you went. You dove deep in that Lincoln pool.
Yeah. Oh, and believe me, I could happily have spent another 10 years doing the research. It was so interesting. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I love doing the research. I love doing the reading. There's always another newspaper archive to look through. There's always another dozen books you could read. Yeah, it's so hard because when the pool is that deep, you know, you never really get to the bottom of it. But that's like, as we were saying earlier about Conan Doyle, I've done a lot of books now, but as someone once said, education never ends.
Do you think that you're going to write another Lincoln book?
Boy, I sure have no plans to, but if I've learned anything, it's, if I've learned anything from our friend Conan Doyle, never close the door.
We have one other Twitter question from Crystal Smidick, who was asking, I thought this was interesting, because particularly in light of the fact that you've written not only so many biographical pieces about Doyle, but also have written pastiche about Sherlock Holmes. She wanted to know, is there any record of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's reaction to the contemporary Sherlock Holmes derivative sort of pastiche and fanfiction that was going on even before the Sherlock Holmes mysteries were done being written, or of the fan activity? What did he think of that?
Well, the ones that jump to mind, I suppose that's two different questions. But the there are a couple that jump to mind, and of course the famous one being William Gillette, who Conan Doyle seems to have had a very, very positive experience with, very, very generous. There's a story to the effect that Gillette visited him and they went over the play together, and Conan Doyle says, and I don't even know if this is true or not, is supposed to have said, it's good to see the old boy again. And of course there's the famous, you may marry him or murder him or do what you wish with him. But he also seems to have had a very high high opinion also of Norwood in the films, and wrote some very generous things about that. But as far as the fan activity, the pastiche activity, I can't imagine that brought him in. That warmed the cockles of his heart, really, because you know, he knew enough to know that he's often portrayed as the man who hated Sherlock Holmes, but boy, he knew what he had done there. He knew that what he had created there. He knew it was special, and he knew it was his property. And I know that he had very strong feelings about that. As he should. You know, he said towards the end of his life, if it hadn't been for Sherlock Holmes, he doesn't know that he could have done more on the other subjects that interested him. But I feel that he was fiercely proud of what he did and understood that he'd done something very special.
It's nice when you see him sort of towards once Sherlock Holmes had died and had returned, it's nice to see him in the sort of post-kind reception to Micah Clark period, when he's mellowing a little bit and seems revisiting the characters as less of a giant burdensome problem and more of a, oh, yeah, that's a thing I did that's comfortable and that will easily bring in a little cash. And, yeah, I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I think I get the strong sense throughout that he didn't want to be remembered for Sherlock Holmes necessarily, but that he seemed to, you know, getting towards the 20s, mellow a lot on the subject of Sherlock Holmes.
I'm sure that's fair to say. I mean, the thing that I always think of, and I find I think about it more lately, is, you know, he was in his mid-20s when he created Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you were mentioning The Ectoplasmic Man earlier. Well, that's a book I wrote when I was about, also in my mid-20s. And I'm proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've gone on to do other things.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I had the opportunity to go on and do other things. Well, Conan Doyle is also a guy who did a lot of other things. And there aren't many of us who would like to, there aren't many of us in any profession who would like to keep doing the job we were doing at age 26 for the rest of our lives.
No.
Without really advancing on it or being allowed to stretch or do anything different. So, you know, he can hardly be blamed if, I think, you know, for the most part, it was, yes, I'm proud of this, and God knows the fame and the money allowed him to do things that he wouldn't have otherwise been able to do. But he felt, and I think rightly so, that he deserved to be remembered for some of the other things he did. And it's always been my belief that if we who admire him could be tempted away from the bright lights of Baker Street now and then, we would find a very interesting and rewarding writer in the shadows.
That seems to be a problem that happens a lot to a lot of artistic people who gain artistic fame, bands, writers, painters. They do one thing that becomes the popular thing, and after that, the public doesn't want them to change, and it limits them, and it kind of sours the original experience for them.
Sure, absolutely. Typecasting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes it's useful to look at Conan Doyle's attitude towards Sherlock Holmes through that lens.
There were people all over the world who were very deeply angered by, well, spoiler alert, but the end of the last season of Downton Abbey. And look, what happened with the end of the last season of Downton Abbey is an actor wanted to get a new gig, and that actor was, for lack of a better way of characterizing it from my perspective, bored of being on a soap opera and loved his job and loved his coworkers, but wanted to explore other projects. Like, there was something of an outcry against that gentleman, and I don't think that it was fair. Because would you just want to keep doing that forever? I mean,
isn't that a good example, though, of how emotionally invested people get? And what better example of that is there than Sherlock Holmes? I mean, sure, people are so deeply invested in it. But I mean, if we learn anything from Downton Abbey, it's that you're walking a fine line. I mean, we love you 1 minute and we hate you the next.
Yeah. Well, at least with Sherlock Holmes, we're all sort of given, to some extent, carte blanche to go write our own Sherlock Holmes and the Lizard People. That's called for emotionally.
I lost Masterpiece.
I am really, that's one of those things where if I hadn't known that it existed, I would be more comfortable, like, in the ignorance rather than the knowledge. With the knowledge, I'm like, oh, this sounds
so cool. if only, yeah. Well.
I just want to know where you got the grenade from.
Who knows? I remember that the lizard people had lots of advantages. They had hovering spaceships.
Sure.
And laser pistols.
Oh.
Yeah.
The asylum homes. Oh.
Dan, would you like to contact the asylum people and offer to write the sequel?
I will get right on that. Point.
I mean, you would have to be topping a mechanized mini T-Rex and Sherlock Holmes shooting a Gatling gun from a hot air balloon at a mechanized dragon.
I believe I'm the man for the job.
Well, are there any more questions? Well, I hope to put you in touch with the asylum folks. A new film will be forthcoming.
I will look forward to that.
Oh, it's going to be beautiful. Thank you so much for chatting with us about all things Doylean and Sherlockian.
Oh, well, thank you. It has been a real pleasure.
Where can we find you if one of our listeners or several would like to visit your website or your Twitter feed or et cetera?
Well, I am on Twitter and Facebook, and the easiest way to contact me is at either stashhour.com or ourofperil.com. And you can click through to both Facebook and Twitter from there.
Thank you so much for chatting with us. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Have fun proselytizing your children.
Yeah, tonight I think it might be the Brett Dying Detective. You know, you put me in that frame of mind.
Oh, we like it. All right, cheers, sir. Go on about your business.
Thank you. Good night.
Gracias.
Tragedy. That sounds better, at least, than that. What is that one movie? Oh, my word, with the dinosaurs? I bet it was a better script than that has. No, I'm good. Yay!